Welcome, everyone, to the Cup of Coffee podcast with me, your host, Tom Dillon. This is being recorded live at our weekly online meeting and broadcast around the world. Today's topic is hands-off stock market investing for real estate investors with Nick McCullum, who joins us from Canada, which is, I think, the first time we've had a Canadian speaker on, which is rather fabulous. So before we start, I'd just like to say by way of a disclaimer that today is a wonderful discussion, but that nothing here said constitutes financial advice. And you should always take professional advice before investing your hard-earned cash. There may be the odd unplanned swear word along the way as well. Right, we can get going. The format today is, as usual, that Nick will speak to us for a bit about what he's got going on. And then once he's done, we'll absolutely take any questions. I'll fire a few in his direction and we'll take any from the floor. So get your thinking caps on. In terms of Nick McCullum is the director of growth at Passive. Passive helps people automate their portfolio management through an easy to use web application that connects directly to their brokerage account. To learn more, visit passive.com, and that's passive without an E. I don't know why E's have become the enemy of all modern companies, but they have. Everyone loves to get rid of that E. I can think of about 30 companies which got rid of the E, but it does get things, makes things shorter, and it does look a bit cool. So I totally get why people are doing it. But it does make out mean reading out the email, the website address a bit more difficult because you have to mention the E's gone. Good morning, Nick. How are you? Are you well?
Yeah, I'm doing well, Colin. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. What have you got for us today?
Yeah, so I'm just excited to be here talking to you guys a bit about how people use our platform to manage kind of a hands-off stock portfolio. We have lots of real estate investors who use the platform, myself included. I've got a couple rental properties, and then I use my own software to manage my portfolio. So I can kind of dive into the details of that if that's a good place to start.
Sorry, I've muted myself. That sounds an excellent place to start. Yeah.
Okay. So I think the best way to understand what Passive does as a platform and as a software tool is to understand like the real problem that we're trying to solve for investors. So Passive's initial prototype was built by one of our co-founders, Brennan Wood, because he was trying to manage his own retirement account. He was trying to manage his wife's retirement account. And he was also trying to manage two education savings accounts for his kids. And he had a lot of kind of tedious problems along the way that he wanted to fix. So namely, because of the different risk tolerances and time horizons of each one of those accounts, he had different target portfolios that he wanted them to be invested in. And he would track his contributions and his holdings for each of those accounts in a massive spreadsheet. The spreadsheet would calculate what he needed to buy or sell to get back to the target allocations that he wanted. And then he would manually enter his trades one by one into his brokerage account. So the initial prototype of Passive eliminated the manual data entry of that process. So he could just read in his holdings from his brokerage account, and the original prototype would calculate what trades he needed to make, and then he would go make them. We've since evolved way past that. So what Passive allows you to do now is you pair Passive to your brokerage account, you set a target portfolio, and then Passive does all of the legwork that allows you to rebalance with one click. So we calculate the trades, we send the trades to your broker sends back trade confirmations, and then with one click, you get rebalanced into your target portfolio. Once that's done, we monitor your account every day, and whenever it's time for you to log back into rebalance again, you'll get a notification via email. So that's like the 50,000 foot overview. I'm happy to dive into any of the specifics if you'd like.
Yeah, go for it. Why don't you tell us a bit more about it, and maybe also, I mean, up to you, of course, we want to talk about, but am I right in thinking that Passive works, I mean, again, you'll tell us, but maybe works mostly with ETFs or with stocks, or how does that work exactly? Like, because some people on the call and listening to the podcast, I feel sure will have active portfolios already of stock, shares, bonds, all of this good stuff, and some people won't have any, but we'll just have a sort of passing interest in what's going on and want to learn more and maybe get involved. So perhaps give us a bit about all of the above, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. So Passive, I guess, as its name implies, was originally conceived to help passive investors. So a passive investor is just someone who kind of wants a diversified index ETF and doesn't want to own individual stocks or individual bonds or anything like that. But our users, just like any software platform, they use this in lots of different ways. So probably the easiest way for people to understand the different ways you can use Passive is to, I guess, really think about a couple of different use cases. So on the most basic level, we have some investors who just use Passive because they want to own like one all-in-one ETF that self-rebalances. And what they use Passive for is they like our cash notifications. So anytime cash hits their account, we will email them. and they can log in and make sure that their new cash gets invested right away. And it's not sitting idly by just, you know, wasting time in their brokerage account. So that's like the most basic use case. At the other end of the spectrum, we have some investors who, you know, they really want a super customizable stock portfolio. So they might have 30 or 50 stocks and they use passive to rebalance that portfolio over time. They might also use some of our other advanced functionality like advanced currency handling, which allows you to specify how much currency you want to hold in each different currency denomination. They might also use our multiple brokerage connection functionality. So if you have investments at two different stock brokerages, passive provides you a centralized place where you can really manage all of your investments in one spot.
Excellent stuff. For those, I realize that, I'm sure people will bring me up on it, and we'll try and put a little glossary in when we launch the podcast, especially. But if we use acronyms, and you're like, "What the hell are these?" And I'll do the same. I'll pull Nick up if he uses some which I don't understand. Then do pop them in, and we'll make sure we, because I don't like it when you know, people are throwing acronyms around. But it's like with any specific field, it tends to become what's the word? Sort of, unfortunately, but inevitable. So ETF is an exchange traded fund. For those who don't know, why don't you just tell people what an ETF is in simple terms, Nick?
Yeah, so I guess an ETF is a type of investment fund that trades on a stock exchange. So its kind of main counterpart or main competitor would be like a mutual fund. And ETFs are a newer form of investment vehicle that offer a number of different advantages over mutual funds. So anyone who follows like the financial news will notice that ETFs will kind of just probably steadily rise in popularity moving forward because they have these structural advantages over mutual funds. There's basically three of them. The first one is that ETFs have better liquidity. So since they trade on a stock exchange, you can buy them whenever you want throughout the trading day, whereas mutual funds just trade once per day. So ETFs have better liquidity than mutual funds. ETFs also have much lower fees than mutual funds. So for the fee-conscious investor who'd rather keep their money rather than spending it on investment fees, ETFs offer advantages that way. And then the third way that ETFs are better than mutual funds is that they offer better tax advantages. So with a mutual fund, if you're an investor in that fund, you pay taxes on the performance of that fund every year. If you own an ETF, conversely, you don't have to pay taxes on your investment in that ETF until the point where you actually liquidate the ETF and sell it. So you have this ability to defer your taxes down the road and only pay them when you want to. So ETFs are, in summary, just a form of investment fund that offer many advantages over mutual funds, which are kind of their legacy counterpart.
Yeah, you sort of mentioned this, but they're also, well, I suppose mutual funds are passive in the sense that they that you don't have to look at them. I mean, you can do, but you don't have to. But ETFs, I'm maybe going to get myself tangled up with words today because I'm not an expert. I dabble, but I'm not an expert in this stuff. But but ETFs typically they follow something, don't they? So they might follow the FTSE or follow like the price of steel, or they might follow like a basket of stocks which is set out at the start, or bonds or whatever it might be. You're not trying to typically beat the market when you buy an ETF. You're simply trying to follow and cash in on whatever the market's doing with all the pluses and minuses that entails. Am I roughly in the right ballpark with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the important thing about that is that because ETFs are passive in nature, that's kind of what causes them to have lower fees than mutual funds, because all of a sudden they don't need like this big research team trying to figure out which stocks are the best. So that's important, because if you think about like the aggregate performance of all investment funds, basically that aggregate performance, if you added all the funds together, is going to be equal to the average market performance minus the total fees paid. So if ETFs can have lower fees than mutual funds, the aggregate performance of ETFs will just always be better than the aggregate performance of mutual funds, because the total sum of all the fees is just smaller. So overall, all the investors in ETFs are better off than all the investors in mutual funds added together. Of course, you might have an argument that you might be able to pick the winning mutual funds, and that might be better than picking the winning ETFs. But all of like the academic literature and just common sense knowledge that I seem to see, like, it doesn't really seem feasible to go out and pick a winning investment fund beforehand.
Yeah, there was a famous bet, wasn't there? I'm sure a lot of people have heard about it already, between Warren Buffett, famous investor, and I've forgotten who was on the other end of it. I guess a mutual fund type guy whose name I don't remember. They had a bet about whether, I'll get the details of this wrong, basically whether ETFs would outperform mutual funds in the long term. I think it was like a 10-year wager, and it was $500,000 or something. And Warren Buffett won it hands down by saying that the passive ETFs would outperform the more actively managed funds. I think I've got that right, haven't I?
Yeah, so the guy who made that bet with Warren Buffett, his name's Ted Seides, and he is a fund of funds hedge fund manager. So he runs, or I think he's actually since left this job. But at the time that they made this bet, he ran a hedge fund whose sole like investment objective was just to invest in other hedge funds. So people would give him money to find good hedge funds to invest in. And hedge funds are just like, if ETFs are like the most passive on one end of the spectrum, mutual funds are kind of in the middle. Hedge funds are like the most active. They're allowed to kind of do whatever they want. Portfolio manager has kind of free investment discretion to make whatever bets they'd like. And when you invest in a hedge fund, you're really taking a big bet on the person managing the hedge fund because they're kind of like a dog with a long leash, I guess is the analogy that a lot of people use. So his bet with Warren Buffett, I think, was $1 million. He's going to pick a group of hedge funds to compete against a passive S&P 500 ETF. And the loser donates $1 million to a charity of the winner's choice. I believe those were the terms. And they made that bet, I think, around 2008 or 2009, right before the S&P 500 went on like one of the biggest rips in the history of finance. So that's kind of Mr. Seides' is, I think, argument was that in a normal market environment, his hedge funds may have performed better, but he happened to make that bet right at the time as an S&P 500 went on a historic run. But he did indeed get clobbered. You're right.
Yeah, well, there you go. And then looking at, I think, again, you'll tell us if I'm right here, but one key thing that you were talking about, and one key thing I think that passive can help with, if is rebalancing. So I certainly find it a pain in the ass. So if, again, for those who are just maybe interested and don't do this, when you start off with investing, one thing you start to think about is, okay, well, what do I want to invest in? Maybe I want to invest in some precious metals or some stocks or some bonds or all these other classes that are out there, those are the bits and pieces. And often people, for whatever reason, work out, there's lots of books to read on this, on what balance you might go for and what you might want to invest in. For example, in Switzerland, they think you're crazy if you haven't got at least 25% of your wealth in gold. And precious metals like gold are also popular in the Asian subcontinent. Lots of families in India, for example, will store their wealth in often in gold. So, but then on the flip side, some people will say, oh, that's crazy. Precious metals don't pay a return. You don't get a dividend from metals. So they'll have stocks or whatever, but whatever numbers you choose, let's say you decide to go very, keep it very simple, 50%, excuse me, 50% stocks, 50% bonds. And let's say it's a kind of year where stocks do really well. Then at the end of the year, it might be through no fault of your own, you've actually got 60% stocks and 40% bonds. And then you've got to rebalance. Then if you choose to, most people would say you want to rebalance that because you don't want to end up, if you've decided for whatever reason that those are the percentages you want in the different asset classes, and diversification is generally considered to be a really good thing when in investing in general, as we all know, as property investors, like it's probably better to have, fingers in lots of pies. That way, if one falls over, you have a problem in one area, it can be balanced off with another area. I think I'm right in saying that. So that can be a pain in the ass process that passive and other similar tools endeavor to make much easier. Am I right about that, Nick?
Yeah, and so ease of use is one important thing, but we also think it actually results in better outcomes as well. So if you think about the way that the rebalancing dynamics work in an investment portfolio, to give you just a real simple example, let's say that you're a big technology investor and you want to invest 50% of your portfolio in Apple and 50% of your portfolio in Tesla. This is not investment advice. I'm just making it easy so that I can kind of walk you through how the calculations work. But let's say Apple goes up and Tesla goes down, and all of a sudden you're now at 60-40 instead of 50-50. What a rebalancing engine will tell you to do is you want to sell your Apple that went up to buy more of your Tesla that went down. So that's basically forcing you to implement like the common sense investing strategy of buy low, sell high, just both at once. So that kind of, I think, results in better long-term investment returns and keeps you also within your risk tolerances for the long run.
Well, there we go. Rebalancing a clock. You mentioned that some people who use your platform sort of interested in cash. So I can't speak for the people. You'll get cash into your account in different ways. You put it there is one way the cash arrives in my account. The other way, I guess, is things like dividends and things like this. And you mentioned that the one problem which I often have on my platform is that I've cashed it in there and don't realize for a while, and then oh crikey, you know, I've had some money sat there not working for me, if you like, which seems a shame. So again, it'll send notifications and things, will it, to bother you, to tell you to do yeah. something about it?
Yeah, so we do email notifications whenever cash hits your account, and we also have another notification engine that kind of is the core of how people rebalance that passive, which relies on this metric called portfolio accuracy. So to just explain how that works real quick, we're always measuring in your portfolio this metric called portfolio accuracy. And that's just a measure of how close your actual portfolio is to your target portfolio. So to give you like some examples, I guess, if your portfolio is perfectly invested in your target portfolio, then your portfolio accuracy will be 100%. Similarly, if your portfolio doesn't own any of your target portfolio, then your portfolio accuracy will be 0%. And then there's a long spectrum from 0% to 100%. Now, we're always comparing that portfolio accuracy to another related metric that we call the drift threshold, which is a metric that you specify as the user. So to provide an example, if you specified your drift threshold to be 90%, that's basically the threshold below which you will get an email whenever your portfolio accuracy falls below it. So if your portfolio accuracy is 95% and your drift threshold is 90%, then nothing happens. But as soon as your portfolio accuracy drifts below that 90% drift threshold, then we'll send you an email that says, hey, your portfolio has drifted. It's time for you to log back in and rebalance with one click. So that's kind of the main other way that our users get notified that it's time to log in and take action in their passive account.
Excellent stuff. You mentioned, I'm just going to ask about currency stuff because that's something that confuses me, which I'd like some clarity on. And then I don't know, after I ask this question, whether it'd be possible to show us what it looks like and what the back end looks like. Are people using it, or if that would be feasable, you should share the screen. For those listening to the podcast, for those watching in black and white, the blue board, the one behind the pink. So for those watching the podcast, we'll I'm sure that Nick will be kind enough to make sure that it works for anyone listening as well as watching. So you don't need to switch off just yet. And then, first, onto Nick, again, for those listening to the podcast, Nick's nodding, so it looks like we'll be able to have a look at that. With the currency stuff then, so let's imagine I invest in some Vietnamese stocks. They're very popular at the moment, or some Japanese stocks, say. Am I taking a currency risk as well as a stock risk? I get the feeling I am.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, like, as you mentioned, kind of all sorts of different risks that you can expose yourself to in your investment portfolio. And currency risk is basically the risk that you buy some currency in a different currency. So like you buy some Japanese yen, and then that Japanese yen moves up or down in value so that when you sell that investment and convert it back to whatever your local currency is, say US dollars, or if it was me, it would be Canadian dollars. So if you converted that Japanese yen back to Canadian dollars, you don't get the same exchange rate as what you paid for it. Now that could be favorable and you might make more money because of that, or it could be a detractor from your returns and you might lose some money on it. So that's just something you kind of have to be aware of. The main reason we built our advanced currency handling functionality is because brokerages charge you to convert currency. And most of the time, people don't realize how much they charge you. It can be as high as like 2-3% of what the value is that you're exchanging. So if you go to buy a big block of stock in a different currency, $100,000, say, they charge you 3%. You just spent $3,000 and it's often by accident. So our advanced currency handling capabilities basically allow you to say, really finely tune how you want to convert your currency so that you don't actually pay those fees by accident. We also have these warnings that pop up whenever you actually go to trade currencies that say, hey, here's how much we're estimating that you're paying in currency conversion fees. So just be careful before you execute this trade, because even though it's like a one-click trade that we calculated for you automatically, there might be some, like, you know, hidden currency implications behind that. So that's kind of the importance of why we put some currency handling into our app. And then just to answer your other question with doing a demo, I'm happy to do like a screen share and just show you a little bit of how our engine works. The markets are closed here right now, so I can't actually like rebalance or anything, but I can show you like what the engine looks like and kind of what our dashboard is.
Yeah, that'd be useful. Why not? I'm sure that'll maybe fire up some give us some something to look at for those able to, and also like we'll see what the buttons are and be able to ask more intelligent questions.
Sounds good. I'll get my screen share going then.
Yes, I don't know if I need to make you a co-host. Let's see if I do. Oh no, you seem to be good. Happy days.
Yeah, so you should be able to see my screen there now.
Yes,
this is our kind of just homepage of our website, and just to show you guys like what the experience is for like a new user, what I'll do is I'll just like create a new account here and link it to my brokerage account so you can see how easy the onboarding process is. So
right, yeah.
Sign up. I'm going to make the name of my account test account.
So for those of you who've never done stocks and shares, I'm sure there are some watching and listening, you know, and none of this is, as we I've probably stopped repeating, but none of this is what's the word, financial advice. But I was surprised when I did this a few years ago, how are you how straightforward setting up being able to trade stocks is. That doesn't mean you should, or it's a good idea necessarily, but it's fairly straightforward. I was interested, it was much easier to set up an account trading potentially millions of pounds of stocks and shares than it was to set up an account on like a betting gambling site, which is probably a good thing, because you're probably going to make more money on here than you are on, you know, ladbrokes.com. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I had to make that account, so that was a perfect little segue. So for anyone watching, I just kind of created my account, and one of the first screens you'll see when you create your account is this setup page, which asks you to connect your brokerage account. So this is a list of all of our supported brokerages. And then this sixth option here, Wealthica, is actually an account aggregator. So if you click through to the Wealthica screen, it gives you access to a couple hundred additional integrations beyond what you see here. So I'm gonna connect my Questrade account. And oh, of course, Questrade is currently undergoing maintenance, so I can't pay.
That is the sound of inevitability.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll just log into my actual account and you guys can still see what it's like.
Everyone make a note of his password.
Yeah. Okay, so this is our homepage here. It'll take a sec to populate with all of my account information. You can see here this massive pop-up that I missed earlier about brokerage maintenance, but of course, this maintenance issue is preventing me from actually seeing anything. Great. How about we can do this? I can record a demo, and maybe once the brokerage kind of API is back up, then we can send it out as a YouTube video to your audience. How does that sound?
That sounds very sensible indeed. So yeah, that's actually stuff. So I'm just catching up with the chat. This is me now, sort of, if anyone's got any questions or wants to ask anything specific about passive or obviously about what Nick's doing or any of that, then pop it in the chat. I'm happy to jump on any of those. In the meantime, I'm going to talk a little bit to Nick about like the wider market, just because it's of interest to me. Let me ask first of all, like a kind of almost a, it sounds like I'm going to throw the ball up and you can whack it out the park. And then I'll come on to wider market questions. Why, sort of give you a chance to talk about the company and things. Why should people use passive? Why would people use passive rather than, we've talked about it a little bit already, why would they use it rather than using either one of your competitors or just doing it themselves?
Yeah, so the main, I guess just to talk about competitors first, because I think that's the most logical place to start. I have never met a company who's doing kind of exactly what passive does. We have two quasi competitors, but neither of them is like an exact fit. So on the one hand, we have lots of people who come to passive after using spreadsheets their whole life to manage their portfolios. So those people are like the highly engaged, like they want to super optimize and customize their investment portfolios. And passive is just like an easier way for them to do that than spreadsheets, because we actually do the trading as well. So that's like our one competitor would be basically Microsoft Excel or Google Sheets. And then at the other end of the spectrum, for a more hands-off investor, another competitor that you could argue that we have is robo-advisors. So companies like Betterment, Wealthfront, I'm sure there's like a million different robo-advisors at this point. But basically what they do is you go to their websites, you fill out a questionnaire, and they will automatically invest you into a portfolio that they think is suitable for you based on the questionnaire that you filled out. Now, the problem with robo-advisors is that they're not customizable at all, and they charge way higher fees than we do. So you have no customizability, and you actually pay more than what we charge. So we're kind of like in the middle for people who want to really optimize and customize their investment portfolio, but do it with minimal time investment and kind of put it on autopilot once they've configured it. Passive is kind of a good tool for that. So that's kind of like the competitive landscape in a nutshell. And then to just talk about why people use us, we know just from like user surveys and stuff that the two main reasons why people use passive is because it saves them time and it saves them money. So on the time front, the whole idea behind passive is that you spend some time at the outset configuring your investment portfolio to be constructed in a certain way. And then passive allows you to put that on autopilot for the rest of your life. So that's how you save time with it, because once you do the initial time investment, you just have to spend maybe a couple minutes every month keeping things on track instead of a couple hours. And then in terms of how it helps you save money, passive is kind of super laser focused on reducing investment fees for everybody. So to the extent possible, we will only place trades that minimize your fees. And then we also are big enablers of people switching their mutual funds to ETFs. So if you have a bunch of high fee mutual funds and you want to get invested in a bunch of low fee ETFs, passive is a great tool that will help you to do that.
Well, there you go. I wish I could do as good a pitch as that for anything. that's if nothing else, an excellent lesson in my book on how to do an excellent pitch. So well done to Nick, and I think that's really clear. I'm now going to talk a little bit about, or ask questions rather, about the market in general, starting with an obvious one. It seems a bit bubbly to me at the minute. Again, none of this is financial advice, but it seems like it's all going to collapse like a flan in a cupboard. What do you think? Or does it not matter what you think?
Yeah, so I mean, I am mostly a follower, just to be like candid. The companies and specific like sectors that I follow most closely is like definitely the technology sector. And that's, I guess, for two main reasons. First of all, I just think it's like kind of interesting, and I've always like been interested in technology. And then the other reason is because like that's where I work. So I'm a software developer. I know the most about software compared to anything else. So most of the time I still feel like a relative idiot. So I don't know how much I actually know on the grand scale of things, but it's definitely what I'm most familiar with. It's where I spend all my time. So I follow software more than any other industry. So that's the industry I'm most familiar with. And I think if you look at the software industry as a whole today, especially like in the super large cap space, I don't think it's bubbly at all. I mean, you get companies like Facebook and Microsoft who are growing, you know, 30% year over year, and they're trading at price to earnings ratios in the 20s or maybe in the low 30s. So I don't think that's like super unreasonable. I see all these comparisons of, you know, 2021 being compared to the 1999.com technology bubble. And I think that's like, doesn't hold water at all, just in terms of like the actual earnings and business valuations of these companies today.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm trying to think. Would you count the ones that do seem bubbly? And I realize it's not a software company. The obvious ones are things like Tesla, aren't they? But that's mostly a car company, stroke battery company.
Tesla is like a super interesting company to think about. I think that's kind of like a binary outcome company right now. So what I mean by that is like that company is either going to do super well or it's going to go bankrupt. So I don't know. If you think about just like the total addressable market of automotive vehicles, if Tesla wins, that's a huge market and they'll probably earn the valuation that they have today. But you also got to kind of keep a pretty rational mindset and like look back and say, how often does a company grab the total addressable market of its entire industry? Like that very rarely happens. So Tesla, I don't know. I've driven in Tesla cars. They're amazing products. I think they're, you know, an order of magnitude better than most other cars, but they're still like not affordable for the majority of the population. They have all these manufacturing issues, and that company's just like structural balance sheet is kind of in distress, to be honest with you. So Tesla, like, super interesting concept. Their products are awesome. If they can kind of ramp up their manufacturing and grab a lot of the market, they'll earn the valuation they have today. But that is a huge if, and not something that me personally is like comfortable kind of betting money in my portfolio on.
Sure. What's this thing with GameStop? I've heard about it a bit, but I don't really know what's going on with it or whether I can make money out of it.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, none of this is financial advice, just to reiterate something I said earlier, but I would be very surprised if people can like systematically make money on GameStop moving forward. I mean, it is, I'm sure people will make money, but it's going to be largely luck in my opinion. So what's going on with GameStop is GameStop, just like as a business, has been really thumped by the whole like internet economy thing. So for anyone unfamiliar with the business model, GameStop is like a video games and video game console retailer. So you can go there to buy your PlayStation and your Xbox and like all the associated games and other things that you need to kind of play it. So in the 1990s and 2000s, GameStop did really well because video games really rose in popularity. Everyone wanted new consoles, and that was great for GameStop. But then as kind of the internet became more and more popular and people were able to download video games instead of having to go to the stores to buy them, GameStop's business just got hammered. So they're closing a bunch of locations. Pretty much everyone unanimously seems to think they're going to eventually go bankrupt, and they're going to kind of be like the Blockbuster of video games. So that's like the setting of this whole fiasco. Because of all those competitive dynamics and the way GameStop's business was performing, it was like the most heavily shorted stock in the stock market pretty much. So what that means is that many portfolio managers and investors had taken portfolio bets such that if GameStop stock declined in price, they would actually make money. Now, the way that that short selling dynamic works is kind of complicated. You basically need to find someone who already owns the stock, you borrow that stock from them in kind. So you basically go to them and you say, hey, I'm going to borrow one share of GameStop from you and I'll give it back to you later. And what you do with that share is you borrow it from them and then you immediately sell it with the hope that you'll be able to buy it back for cheaper later. So once you buy it back, you return it to them and your profit is the difference between where you sold your GameStop stock and where you bought it back. So it's kind of complicated, but basically the understanding that dynamic is important because it helps you understand what happened with GameStop. So if the price of GameStop starts to increase rapidly, all of the lenders who gave people their stock to sell short will ask for their stock back because it's increasing price and they're going to want to sell it. So that causes the short sellers to buy back their stock, give it back to their lenders, and creates kind of all this extra buying activity, causing the price to surge in value. And that's called a short squeeze. So sorry, this is taking longer to explain than I thought, but basically what happened was all of these people in this Reddit subreddit called Wall Street Bets decided unanimously that they were going to try to create an artificial short squeeze by all buying the stock on the same day. So that's exactly what they did. All these people on Reddit bought the stock on a certain day. And I think the stock went from like $14 a share to like $350 a share. A bunch of short sellers went bankrupt. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
Wow, interesting. Interesting how the market can be sort of manipulated a little bit, but that doesn't mean people should be afraid of it because there's still good companies doing good things out there. I think I've half stolen one of Colin's questions, which has popped into the chat. My apologies. I didn't see your question and steal it. But Colin, why don't you pop in with, well, maybe half of question one and certainly question two, whatever you fancy.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, so just to add, it was an excellent explanation. Thank you very much. Just to add to that, the so what happened, which has caused a lot of fuss, Tom, is that obviously through a bit of pressure, as I understand it, because there were big multi-billion pound hedge funds who had shorted GameStop stock, they forced some of the platforms to freeze further purchases of the GameStop stock. Shares, I'll call them shares, that'll make it easier, GameStop shares. And of course, this is a massive fuss because people are basically interfering in the open market and stopping your ordinary man on the street like you and me from buying shares that they may choose to want to buy. You could sell them, but you couldn't buy them. So my first question for you, Nick, was were clients on your platform impacted by that freeze on GameStop share purchases?
Yeah, so fortunately for us, so the first brokerage that Passive was ever integrated with is a Canadian brokerage called Questrade. And just because of like our long living relationship there, that's like where the majority of our client assets are, just because we've been with them for the longest. And Questrade actually kind of held strong and they never froze any trading at all. So just because of that, we were super, you know, happy to be partnered with them, that they continued to allow their clients to freely trade whatever assets they wanted, which is kind of, we think, pretty awesome. And then at some of our smaller integrations, I'm trying to think, there were some other smaller brokerages, not smaller in terms of the size of the brokerage, but smaller in terms of the number of passive clients who connect to that brokerage, if that makes sense. We had a number of smaller integrations who did kind of implement some trading freezes on stocks like GameStop. And there's a couple other stocks that were kind of manipulated in similar ways this week, like AMC Entertainment, which is an operator of cinemas in the United States. They had kind of some similar activity going on inspired by the whole GameStop fiasco. So there's that. If anyone's interested in reading more about this, it's really non-transparent as to why these people froze trades. So there's kind of like two main theories. The first one is that, like Colin alluded to, there's hedge funds who are going to go bankrupt from this short squeeze, and they basically pressured brokerages like Robinhood to stop trading. So that's kind of explanation number one. Explanation number two, which I haven't had a chance to super read into yet, but I have seen some people on Twitter and elsewhere post that there are certain requirements for collateral for brokerages that made it really hard for them to actually just operate in an environment where a stock goes from $14 to $350 or what have you. So that's kind of an explanation that some people are using, but I think that it'll take some time and potentially some like regulatory intervention for us to know like what really happened on the inside during this whole situation. But just to summarize, I guess, brokerages froze trading on GameStop and some other stocks, and it created a lot of ill will with their customers because these customers kind of rightly think that if they sign up for a service that whose mission is to allow them to trade stocks, then they should be able to trade as they will and not as their broker tells them to. So there's a lot of kind of distress and a lot of bad publicity for people who did freeze trading this week.
Interesting. And thank you very much, Nick. Second question, Colin? Or has that been, have we covered that?
Yeah, it was kind of a follow-on question, really. I don't know whether this is really a question that you can answer, Nick, but given my understanding is that colluding to artificially move a stock's price in the market is, I understood, to be illegal. Do you think that the regulators could take action against the Reddit community, that at least ones they could identify, for colluding to move the market that way?
Yeah, this is a super interesting question and something I've thought about a lot, because you are right. Like, mass manipulation of market prices is extremely illegal. I don't know if anyone's seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, but that's kind of the whole premise of that movie. He, you know, had a big brokerage, and his brokers would buy stocks and then pitch those stocks to his clients so that they would buy up the shares. And then once the shares had risen in price, his brokerage would sell them. So that's called a front running. And that's basically what happened here with GameStop as well. The difference here, though, is that since it was on Reddit, it's all anonymous. So I don't know what the heck is going to happen. If these were real people exposing their actual identities, I'm sure that they would get penalized in some way. But Reddit is completely anonymous, to my understanding. And even to the extent that they do have like personally identifiable information associated with the Reddit account, I'm sure that Reddit sharing that information with the regulators is probably like against their privacy policies. So I don't know what the heck's going to happen. It's going to be super interesting to watch. I would be surprised if the regulators didn't try to do something, but it's uncertain to me how far they will get.
Nick, but isn't attacking a short seller perfectly legitimate? If the Reddit community was a single individual, they would be perfectly at liberty to attack a short seller, right? And that's exactly how George Soros broke the UK Bank of England, right? When the UK left the exchange rate mechanism, he just had a bigger war chest than the government and broke the economy. So what is wrong with what Redditors did? They just saw an opportunity to exploit a weak counterparty in the market and break their trading position. Okay, it's game theoretic, but you know, there are large players in the market. You have to take a game theoretic approach.
Yeah, so the short seller, like the fact that this was done to harm short sellers, I don't think actually kind of has any impact on like the regulatory stance here. The reason why I would say, I would guess this is illegal is because it was like coordinated between multiple people. So you're not, technically supposed to work together to move security prices to the extent possible. And the fact that this was done in unison is kind of, I guess, what makes it.
Yeah, but that's exactly what fund managers do. That's the job of a fund manager, is to take the funds from all of their community of investors and then act as in unison. But the point is, it's one controlling mind directly controlling the funds rather than people issuing instructions like a stock tipping service. So I don't really see the difference when you start picking it apart like that.
That's a good point. I mean, at the end of the day, like I said, these are all anonymous, so it's unclear how far the regulators will actually be able to get, but it'll be super interesting to see it play out in either case, I think.
It will. Thank you very much for an interesting chat, and it almost doesn't matter, does it? It's GameStop, because it'll be someone else next week, but it's also interesting to chat about little things in the market. But I mean, yeah, it's just an interesting example. To totally take things left field, because I like to test Nick's mental agility before he's had breakfast, presumably, I was interested, and it's almost moving away from the market, really, was how does... And without getting political, I'm not trying to delve into your personal political views, but how has Brexit been viewed by Canada in general? Has it been total indifference, or is everyone like, oh, that's crazy, or a total mixture, or how's that gone down?
Yeah, so I actually can vividly remember the day that I found out that Brexit was happening. I was on the subway in Toronto going to work, and a reporter was on the subway beside me, and he just told me. I didn't even find it out like on the news or anything. So
it's good you got your own reporter. I usually have to watch the telly.
He was just a random acquaintance on the subway. Canada's a pretty friendly place, so when we ride the public transit, we often just chat with each other, which is kind of nice. But Brexit, I would say, since then has not really been discussed much here in Canada. Like it's a pretty under the radar phenomenon. Obviously there was a lot of discussion around it when it was first announced, but I think there was a really long lag between when it was announced and when it was supposed to be executed, like a year or more.
Sure.
And after it was announced, I don't really remember hearing too much more about it after that.
Yeah, okay. And it's not been in the news recently, because it kind of happened on the 31st of December last year, but that didn't, and I'm not being critical, I'm not sure that much Canadian news makes our sort of 6 p.m. Roll call either, but that didn't really tickle the surface.
No, I mean, on the one hand, no, I didn't hear anything about it. But on the other hand, you're probably asking the wrong guy because I am not a big news watcher. I just have tried to tune the news out as much as possible. It's just a little life hack for living a happier life, at least for me anyway.
No, very sensible and the same. So yeah, makes sense. Okay, that excellent stuff. Well, unless anyone else got any questions, we'll probably wrap it up there. Did you have anything, final thoughts? Fraser Crane, I'm listening. Do you have any final thoughts, Nick? Are you happy that you've told us what you need to tell us?
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I'd add is that if anyone's interested in checking out like our investing platform, the website's passive.com, PASSIV.com. There's no E on the end of passive. And if you'd like, to have any specific questions answered or if you'd like a demo, just email me. My email's nick.mccullum@passive.com.
Excellent stuff. We'll put Nick's, well, obviously the URL and Nick's email and possibly a YouTube video type thing in with the podcast if anyone wants to catch that. This podcast, as always, will be released a week today, so a week after recording, which means I think we've got one being released in about 10 minutes from last week, which I think was Teresa talking about Will, so that's coming up, and so on and so forth. Thank you all very much for being here, really appreciate it, especially to our speaker and to those listening to the podcast, Nick McCullum, obviously our excellent speaker today. Tune in next week when we'll be joined by, we're getting a lot of our colonial friends and cousins on, in the shape of John Corey next week, who'll be speaking to us about, well, I think crowdfunding and tech. We're trying to work out the exact exact thing. One of John's claims to fame is that many years and moons ago he worked with Steve Jobs. So an interesting fellow to listen to.